Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien.
I figure that since you don't have much choice about what air you breathe and very little choice about what water you drink, protecting those two things is a pretty important thing for the government to do. And that's why we've called Betsy Sutherland. Betsy Sutherland monitored water quality for the Environmental Protection Agency and, in fact, was director of the Office of Science and Technology for that function when she retired in 2017. So, Betsy, how long had you worked for the EPA in all?
33 years, up until August of 2017.
And then you decided to call it quits. What happened?
Well, it was a combination. I had family medical care that I was providing, but also by August of 2017, which was just 7 months into the Trump administration, I realized that they really planned to dismantle the agency and to repeal almost all of the human health protections that we'd put in place over the past decade.
Right. And you also say that Scott Pruitt, who was EPA director at the time, suddenly his door was closed to people like you?
Scott Pruitt would not speak with any of us. He spoke only and met only with industry representatives. And then a day or two after meeting with them, he would issue directives to the career staff to begin repealing a rule that one of his political donors had just asked him to do. So faced with my own family needs for my time, I chose to resign.
Now, you say that these were rules that donors were insisting on. Was it as blatant as that? There was no other reason for these rules to change?
Yes, it actually was as blatant as that. And the reason I say it is because even when he is in the process, EPA is in the process of repealing rules now, it's not for the entire industry sector at their request. It's really at the quest sometimes of just one or two companies.
The administration, I'm sure, would contend that it is in nobody's interests to allow increases in air and water pollution, and they're just trying to simplify the rules. Is there any substance to that?
No, there's no substance to that at all. In fact, one that they're currently engaged in is relooking at the mercury air pollution levels that have been in place and that everyone is complying with in the electric utility industry. And we now find that every electric utility in the country has asked EPA not to get rid of those mercury emission standards. They're all in compliance with them, and they all agree that mercury, which is a known neurotoxin, should be controlled by their utilities. However, we know that Bob Murray, who's the CEO of the biggest coal company in the country, Murray Energy, is the one who has asked EPA to proceed with this repeal, and it looks like they're in the process of doing that. And every electric utility has written in opposition to it. Today, we find even the Catholic bishops have written in protest because they're so concerned that removing this protection will be a huge input of neurotoxins to the unborn and to children throughout the country.
But did I hear you say that the plants themselves don't want to change the standard?
They do not. They have asked the agency not to repeal these mercury emissions because they're already in compliance. But I think, again, Bob Murray and others of the coal political donors behind the Trump administration are insistent that this rule should go, and they're very pleased in the coal industry that the justification for these mercury emissions has been severely undermined by this new proposal from EPA.
But wouldn't that be I'm just trying to think this through. If a local utility in this area, for example, suddenly announced, instead of scrubbing the mercury out of the air, we are now going to start emitting it and burning more coal, that would be a public relations disaster.
Absolutely. And I think that is why the electric utilities are asking EPA to please stand down on this.
Can they be forced to turn their scrubbers off? If they don't want to do it, can they be forced to turn their scrubbers off?
They can't be forced. The concern we have in the environmental community is once you have undermined the foundation, the justification for mercury emissions, it could lead not to just concern over control for mercury, but concern over control for all toxic air emissions.
So even though they might change this rule, there really is, it is unlikely, I think I hear you're saying, that the power companies would turn off those scrubbers, even if it is slightly more expensive. But then going forward, if there were any more attempts to further clean the air, this might inhibit that.
That's correct. I think that's the more likely scenario. But there's always an option, you know, that there's bad actors out there that might be willing, should this emission standards be repealed, to just turn the equipment off and save the operation costs.
Now, are there, since you've left, are there, I assume you're still following this, so since you've left, are there other red flags we should be aware about at the EPA?
I think what EPA has done on the repeals, they're now going after the scientific foundation behind all our rules, whether it's for air, water, or land. They have also gone after the scientific advisors that weigh in on the scientific credibility of EPA's rulemaking by removing any of the academics who have ever received EPA grants from those advisory bodies and putting in place industry scientists or state scientists who are openly opposed to environmental regulations.
Right. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding the other side of this. I'm sure the argument would be that the regulations have gone too far. They've gotten too precious. They're talking about parts per billion, which don't make any difference one way or the other. It's not strictly based on science that, in fact, these rules were part of an agenda just to undermine coal for political reasons. You're sure none of that could be the case?
I'm convinced that is not the case. What I find is that every rule that they're in the process of repealing was developed over many years where there was much input, not just from the general public and the public health community, but from the industry themselves. And believe me, by the time those rules went final, they had been thoroughly vetted about their economic impact and their public health impact. So when the Trump administration came in and in the first 2 years began repealing over 80 environmental regulations, clearly the amount of time they spent into doing that deregulation was far less than the enormous amount of time and effort that went into promulgating those rules to begin with.
Betsy Sutherland, formerly of the Environmental Protection Agency. Betsy, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for calling.
Let's talk about reparations. The subject has come up on the campaign trail. By reparations, I'm talking about compensating the descendants of slaves as a compensation for slavery. We called up Derek Hamilton at the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State. You might remember that we spoke to him, months ago, about baby bonds, giving every American newborn some seed capital that they can eventually put towards an education. So when it comes to reparations, there are a few big questions. How much will it cost? Where would the money come from? How do you decide who gets it? And the big question that some tribes wrestled with at the outset of the casino boom, who determines who is worthy to receive that money?
Well, when Congressman John Conyers was in Congress, every year he would put forth a bill that never got out of the House, the H.R. 40, which was to establish a commission that would be obviously learned and have expertise to help make some of those determinations. So because it's difficult doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. You give an example of tribal membership as a designation that proved to be difficult, but yet they still went forth with some type of designation. And no policy will be perfect. If we expect perfection from a policy, we would have no policy. But nonetheless, we are sophisticated enough and we have technical know-how to try to anticipate the concerns that you've expressed and make a more perfect policy.
I just think you're going to have to do a lot of detective work.
Oh, you're absolutely right. The moral hazard incentives will be strong.
Of course, a lot depends on what the amount is we're talking about. The original promise was 40 acres and a mule. And I know some people have said, well, that has to be translated into today's dollars. Do you have any ballpark figures for what each individual payment would amount to? Because I'm looking, frankly, at what the reaction of non-minorities is going to be And it'll be one thing if it turns out this is a payment of like $1,000 or $2,000 a person. It'd be much different if the payment was like $20,000, $40,000, $60,000, $100,000 a person. So do you have an idea what order of magnitude we're talking about?
Well, it's going to be more than $20,000 per person. It probably will be up there in the hundreds of thousands per person. First off, it doesn't have to be distributed as an individual payment as the only mechanism of distribution. But nonetheless, the whole plan for reparations would be in the trillions of dollars. Now, our country has demonstrated quite recently the capacity to generate trillions of dollars in a pretty expedient way. And I'm referring back to the last financial crisis, particularly with quantitative easing that took place from the Federal Reserve.
Basically, Bank. The printing of money is what we're talking about.
It's not just the printing of money. I mean, that's a fallacy. The printing of money is one capacity, but the federal government could buy stocks from corporations and issue stocks as a form of payment. I mean, here's another point that we need to consider. Basically, as a group, the only factor of production that blacks generally own is their labor itself. Mm-hmm. Blacks as a group do not have a whole lot of land ownership in America, nor do they own the means of production in America. And that is a direct legacy of these atrocities that took place in the past. So when we're thinking of a comprehensive reparations program, we would consider the ways of payment to fortify ownership of the means of production, including corporations as well as land. Otherwise, you could generate a stimulus effect where that transfer goes right back into the dominant population in a multiplying way because they own the means of production. Mm-hmm. Reparations is not something we can do overnight. I think the first step is really to establish that commission to, one, acknowledge the impact of what those atrocities did to a population over time. Then the country can come together as a more perfect union where this division along race becomes less salient and we have less opportunity for politicians to come along and to divide us along racial dimensions. We really need to grapple with what took place in our past and redress it.
And I understand the need to make sure people understand the reasons for this. That's obviously important. And it's really important if we're talking about payments of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Let me just bring up this idea that part of what might help sell this, if I may use that term, is that it would make a lot of the expense of welfare programs unnecessary. Is that part of what you envision here?
Well, you know, reparations is framed as addressing inequality not from a deficit perspective, but from a privilege perspective. It recognizes some of the structural advantages that some may have had over time and tries to offer similar structural facilitation to other groups that didn't have it. Unfortunately, a lot of our anti-poverty programs today offer a population subsistence. And to me, that's the wrong way of thinking about inequality. I mean, frankly, I trust people in general. I believe that people, regardless of race and regardless of birth condition, desire to be productive members of society, to be civically engaged. So you are right that reparations would also have the benefit of changing the ways in which we think about poverty and address poverty.
I've also heard from financial experts that if you want to boost the economy, you don't give money to people who already have it. You give money to people who need it and will spend it, put it to the consumer economy right away. So I think there are many ways to justify it. But I do think, I don't know, that when you threw out the figure of a couple $100,000, I said, oh, man, this is going to be a big fight.
Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be a fight. We need to think about not just economics for the sake of hoarding resources so that we can have more and more and more, but really trying to facilitate people's ability to be their best selves.
Derek Hamilton is the executive director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. We've been talking about the concept of reparations. Derek, thank you very much. Good to talk to you again.
Dave, I always enjoy being on your show.
And now for your daily dose of kindness. This story comes to us from Heartthreads. Candace has spent most of her life incarcerated. She had a tough life growing up that included abuse at home. A few years ago, Candace was introduced to Jennifer, a sheriff's deputy, as part of a mentorship program for inmates. At first, Candace says she was skeptical.
They paired me up with a cop, like, this is stupid. Like, what are we going to do? What are we going to talk about?
And Jennifer had her doubts as well.
I never planned to actually enjoy my time with her.
But they quickly found out that they had more in common than they thought. And after Candace got out of prison, Jennifer's mentoring continued through the transition and beyond.
I love that woman. Like, I love, like, it makes me cry. Because no matter what I go through, she's just been there, you know what I mean? Like, my ups and downs, and I'm telling you, I'm not a walk in the park.
And Jennifer says the relationship hasn't just been life-changing for Candace, but for her, too.
Our mentorship and friendship has just opened up my world and given me an experience that I don't think I would have ever had with any other relationship in my life.
The two have profoundly changed each other, and now they want to continue making a positive impact, sharing their story with others.
Time for the Sports Insider, sponsored by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, the man who dominates sports talk the way the Mariners dominate Major League Baseball, Danny O'Neill. Wow, what's going on, man?
They are possessed. All it took was underselling.
They just had to undersell.
Years of overselling and underdelivering. Now we've got an underseller who's overdelivering. They're clobbering people, and King Felix gets out there. And you know what? I've got two words about King Felix's performance.
Yes.
Not bad. It wasn't bad.
Well,
I don't know if I would categorize it.
Was it as good?
Maybe. He had some terrible defense.
You sound like Robert Mueller.
Yeah.
Not bad, but you won't say it's good.
It's not bad. It's not bad. Was it good? If he pitches that way the whole year, he's going to remain on the Mariners roster. That's what I would say. Like, that is a totally acceptable major league start. Like, if that's the bar, if that's where the average comes out, mm-hmm. I am going to consider myself pleased might be an overstatement, but I'll take that. I'll sign up for that right now because it's significantly better than what we were getting the second half of last season. And here's a headline you will not see in any of this morning's papers, or websites, or anything like that.
Yes.
Whoa, baby. Felix delivers first win in 9 months. He hadn't won a game since June 30th. 9 months, Dave. You get it? Because 9 months is the general time that it takes for a person to conceive and then deliver the baby.
No, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
You would have written that had you still been working for a newspaper.
Yeah, I would have. Yeah. Probably somebody would have changed it because they would have thought it. And then I would have tried to say, like, he labored for 9 months to get
really,
this
somebody
victory.
Somebody dare change
a
Danny O'Neill headline?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, someone is relying as me on puns, but they'll put in a headline that says the Mariners get a bad whiff of cologne, which was funny because when they did it, that person's last name was C-O-L-O-N.
I get it.
So when you read it, it was not cologne. Yeah. It was colon. It was colon, and it was gross. It was a gross headline. It's the best / worst headline I've ever seen in a newspaper. Shout out to Dwight Perry at the Seattle Times.
Oh, well, I can see why you're in radio now. So the Mariners beat the Angels, although, as it says here, the Angels, 6-3. And the record's now 6-1, which is, if you don't count Philadelphia, which has only played three games, it's the best record in baseball.
It's unbelievable. They are off to a 6-1 start. We got one more against the Angels, and then we head on to Chicago, where the White Sox are going to have their home opener. I've decided that the way the Mariners are playing, we should characterize all these things as physical altercations, because the Mariners beat the Angels about the head and shoulders for the better part of 9 innings, drubbing their way to a 6-3 victory.
I see.
Jay Bruce delivered the finishing blow, the knockout punch, as it were, a 2-run homer in the bottom of the 7th, and the Angels, caught flat-footed, simply could not respond before the referee counted to 10.
Could you say that King Felix had the batters in a full Nelson the whole time?
I would say this. King Felix found his range early with the jab. He wasn't overpowering, but he fought. He fought in the clinches. He was able, when it gets a little, the dirty boxing, they like to call it in the MMA, where you're kind of close together and you just deliver short little punches, and it's not overpowering. It's certainly not any graceful, and you're not knocking anybody out, but you're doing work. You're carrying the rounds. You're hauling them out into the end of the game where the Mariners were able to finish them off.
Wow. You're almost more interesting than the game.
That's impossible.
Let's talk about
defense, because they can't play any. God, they're awful, Dave.
What?
They made 4 errors last night. The Mariners this year so far can be spelled with 12 E's. Marineeeeeeeeeeeeers.
You left out an O.
He misses the print media. I just get, we just had eight fantastic headlines just during this, you know, and we only filled like 3 minutes with them.
Yeah, my material is going to rot here on the airwaves.
You could have put it in 72 point type and the whole afternoon edition could be locked down.
God, that would be horrible for everyone. Could you imagine if they had to listen to me and read what I had to say?
So is that the price? Well, they have to. There's a website, you know. They have to be good at the plate because they're so terrible in the outfield.
That's correct. And as a matter of fact, I thought maybe we should start giving them oven mitts. Onion mitts might be a good idea too. But just have them field with oven mitts, and you can grab it with either hand, and you can throw it because they're not able to throw it anyway when they're barehanded. Ryan Healy will airmail one right over the head of them. But you're right, they do, and with the bullpen as well. The bullpen, they did acquire a pitcher yesterday whose name is Sadzek. It's Sadzek.
Yeah.
Only when I looked at it, I was like, oh, tell me his name is not pronounced Sadzak.
No.
I do not want his name to be pronounced Sadzak. And he goes along. You have a natural pairing there with Swarzak, who's a pitcher who's been hurt so far. Swarzak and Sadzak. It's like a comedy routine.
Are they going to continue to win, Danny?
I hope so. Yes, absolutely.
Or does it matter as long as they continue to spin out headlines like this?
No, I do believe that they're going to continue to win because they found the secret to success, which was underselling themselves.
Yeah.
Hey, we're probably not going to be very good. In fact, we might be outright bad. Oh, by the way, here's our best start in, I don't know, 15 years.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying it.
I can't remember a start like this.
It's fantastic. It's really fun. Yeah. It's fun to watch that team. Jay Bruce, he's the man with two first names. He's clobbered three home runs. He started out 1 for 15. He's hit three home runs in the past three games.
What the heck?
Yeah, two first names. See what he does for you. It's like Russell Wilson is the man with two last names.
Uh-huh.
Jay Bruce, the man with two first names.
Wow. What a team they would make.
Yeah, I know. If you could, Jay Wilson and Bruce Russell.
Shall we talk tomorrow?
Yeah, probably. Okay. I should try and calm down.
No, please don't. Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. Thank you, Danny.
You bet.
Choke points. Let's go. Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. Drivers had to endure a fully closed I-90 last night. It caught some people by surprise. As the light rail project to Bellevue reached a major milestone. So explain what they're working on there and when it's going to be closed again, Chris.
Okay, what we're dealing with here is they're building the railroad tracks, the elevated structure that will go from the middle of I-90 there over to Bellevue Way. So the elevated structure goes over the westbound lanes of I-90 to connect there at Bellevue Way. So the reason what they've been doing is they've been using something called a form traveler. It's something that builds the structure as it moves forward. And what it did is it eliminated the need for a series of a bunch of closures because they really aren't working from below.
Moves 12 feet at a time, so the traveler will move out, it pours the concrete, it cures, and then it'll move out again. So it basically sort of spits it out in front of it a little bit.
And so since it has reached the middle point of that connection between Bellevue Way and the middle of I-90, the form traveler needs to be dismantled, taken off, and moved to the other side, to the Bellevue Way side of things, so it could start coming the other direction so they can meet in the middle. That's why we had the overnight closure last night, is because they were removing the apparatus from the bridge. And I just found out, you know, just a few minutes ago from Rochelle Cunningham at Sound Transit that there will be another full closure of westbound I-90 tonight, basically from, you know, Factoria all the way across the East Channel Bridge to Bellevue Way. So there will be a detour in place. Now, Carolyn, you experienced the detour this morning, kind of caught you off guard, and you said the detour wasn't very clear. What did you experience?
Well, first of all, I had no idea it was happening. And so then I was like, okay, so I have to, where I'm coming from, I had to detour over, like I'm going towards Issaquah and then turn around and come back. And so I thought, oh, maybe this is the end of it, and I'll just, I don't know. I was just rolling with it. So then it swung me to going towards Bellevue, and then I got off, and then the detour wasn't clear where I was to go next. So then I got back on, you know, 405, and then it was just,
it was over.
I had to go back up around Issaquah, come back, and then I just like said, forget it. I'm going on 520.
Okay. Well, that's what your guys are going to experience again overnight. The detour route will take you, say, if you're coming westbound on I-90 from Issaquah, okay? You're going to get off onto northbound 405 and get off at the first exit, which is Southeast 8th, okay? You're going to swing under the freeway And Carolyn, where you made the mistake is you got right on to get back onto southbound 405. No, don't do that. Continue on Southeast 8th as long as it goes, and then there will be detour signs there for you to follow to get on at Bellevue Way and then back onto the freeway there. So, yeah, I will let them know that their signage could have been a little bit better or maybe more than a little bit better. But either way, what they're doing here is, you know, we're about halfway through that part. By November, we should have that form traveler moving all the other way, and that point at that point, the span over I-90 will be done. They're more than 50% complete on the entire project to the east side, and they're still on track to be ready to deliver light rail to Bellevue in 2023, Redmond in 2024, and we could start seeing the track being laid on the floating bridge as soon as this month. So they're chugging along. God, I don't intentionally make all these puns.
They're not puns when they relate to the actual type. I mean, the metaphor is a railroad metaphor.
Yeah.
So why should it not be used in a railroad story?
Because it's just kind of coming out of my mouth without thought, many things.
Not a problem.
For another update, since we are talking about ST2 projects, this is an ST2 project, not ST3. Going up to Northgate, if you've been up there lately, you can see that that's really coming along. The station's coming along. They're set to get that into service by 2021. There's some work being done this week. They're right around that station. So daily from 5A to 3P, 100th Street, Northeast 100th Street is going to be closed there. That's the first street south of the park and ride and everything by the mall there. So just be prepared for some delays there all week this week. But they're moving. They're getting their job done.
And here it is Tuesday morning, which means we go live to the nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold from the Washington Post. And before we get to your latest piece, which is on Donald Trump's finances, I need to ask you, is Joe Biden actually in trouble here for being too nice to women?
Well, I'm not sure nice is the right word to use, but yeah, Joe Biden is not actually in the presidential race. He's been flirting with it for months now. And one of the things that's come out is that his sort of habit of being very touchy, physically close to women, sometimes women he doesn't really even know. The one example that set this off was this former candidate for statewide office in Nevada, Lucy Flores, said that Biden had come out in 2014 to help her in a campaign event in Reno, and all of a sudden she finds him like sniffing her hair and giving her like a slow kiss on the top of the head, which she didn't take as sexual harassment, but she also didn't take as welcome either. And that's how Biden relates to women, and I think we're going to find a lot of other people who've had similar experiences.
Yeah. Now, is this where the Me Too movement is going? Because it seems to me, I mean, obviously not women, but this does not approach the kinds of physical assaults that some of these other men have done. So for now, you're going to count an invasion of personal space as part of Me Too?
No, I don't think it is, as you said, it all compares to what people like Matt Lauer, Harvey Weinstein, people who committed sexual assault or were accused of committing sexual assault. It's not in the same league. The question is, if that's the way Biden acts around women, and there's all kinds of stories about it, you know, we're not talking about convicting him of a crime. We're talking about electing him president. You know, is that going to hurt him in a race against a guy, Donald Trump, who has his own history of accusations of a different kind? The accusations against Trump are of a more aggressive, less sort of familiar kind of character. But is that going to hurt Biden with younger voters? Is it going to hurt Biden with women? The whole premise of the Joe Biden candidacy is not his ideas or anything about him, except that he's electable. And if you start to see things like this chip away at the electability, the logic for him kind of goes away.
I've heard speculation this is an inside job. This is a way for at least the more left wing of the Democratic Party to crush this candidacy before it begins.
You have heard speculation about that. The biggest obstacle for Biden now is Biden. Like, if you're a Democrat in the age of Donald Trump and, you know, you don't know if you want to run for president, to me, that's the biggest red flag for him. He hasn't gotten in yet. He seems to be kind of mooning around thinking about it, which is the same thing we heard about Beto O'Rourke a few weeks ago. And I have the same reaction. Like, if Donald Trump is president, you're a Democrat, and you don't know if you want to run for president, I'm not sure you should. If you don't have that fire, don't get into it.
The problem with Biden to me is I've heard quite a few of his speeches, and it's just so dripping with sincerity. There's nothing, I guess, bad about that, except it just gets cloying after a while. And then with this on top of it, it makes his candidacy seem like a bad idea.
I think, honestly, being in the Senate for a long time is terrible training for being president, because in the Senate you can talk for as long as you want, and no one listens and no one stops you. And that's not what you need to, the approach you need to have to being out on the campaign trail. That could be a real handicap for him.
Yeah. All right. So Donald Trump's finances, you've delved into this. And so what is different about what you found in your latest story here, David?
Well, we wrote about these things called statements of financial condition. These were sort of official-looking documents that Trump had given out to potential lenders, potential insurers, people he wanted to do business with. And they were supposed to reassure you that if you were going to do business with Donald Trump, you should consider him a great credit risk. He had lots of money, lots of great assets. There's no chance he would take your loan or take your insurance and not pay you back. So we looked at basically whether he was truthful. And in those statements, there's lots of exaggerations and inflations and some outright errors of fact. And the difference there that could be legally important for Trump is those errors. The inflations, the sort of the deviations from standard accounting procedure that made Trump seem wealthier than he really was, some of those are disclaimed at the beginning. Trump's accountants write a letter at the beginning being like, look, there's lots of things in here that maybe you shouldn't trust. If you knew the full picture, you wouldn't get the same impression. But there's other things that weren't disclaimed. Like Trump said he had 24 more housing lots to sell in California than he really did, which is $72 million at least in potential income that he's claiming that he didn't have. If any of those representations were material to a lender, you know, for you and me, that would mean some serious legal liability.
Yeah. Well, the accountants, though, would append a warning to these things. I'm just looking at this one that you've quoted here. The accountant said, we have not audited or reviewed the accompanying financial statement and accordingly do not express an opinion or provide any assurance about whether the financial statement is in accordance with accounting principles generally accepted in the United States of America. That's a pretty complete hands-off saying, look, this could be made up for all we know.
It is crazy that an accounting firm would do such a thing, but they did.
What's crazier is that someone would lend them money after seeing a statement like that, isn't it? I mean, if somebody
totally
does
agree.
That, isn't that on them?
That's an interesting question. We heard people say, you know, look, no serious, you know, this can't be fraud because no serious lender or insurer would act on this. You know, they would see right through this. So some people did loan Trump money after he sent them this. Deutsche Bank did a few times. But, you know, if they said, okay, well, we got that statement and we disregarded it, and then we did a real review of Trump's finances and found that the truth was still reassuring, you know, I think it would be hard to make a case against Trump if Deutsche Bank or some other insurer didn't come out and say, yes, I felt defrauded, I was misled. And these statements are so ridiculous, it might be hard to find somebody who said that.
Is anybody going to be sympathetic, though, to the people who were apparently hurt here, if anyone? Because the bottom line is, here's a rich guy ripping off other rich guys who probably should have known better. So, you know, it's like gang wars in Chicago. They're shooting at each other.
Well, it seems like we're a long way from knowing if there's going to be any sort of legal, you know, sort of penalty for Trump or a legal case. What's happened so far is regulators in New York State have requested information from Trump's insurers and lenders about whether they got these documents and how they used them. The House Oversight Committee has requested lots of documents from Trump's accountants about how they were prepared. Yeah, that's the very, very early stages of an investigation. It's really early to say what, if anything, this will turn into.
All right, what is this thing about the number of floors in Trump Tower? I know we've talked about this before, but it surfaced again in one of these documents. So how many floors are there in Trump Tower?
There are 58.
58 physical floors. But as I recall you telling me, that they are not numbered that way on the elevators, right?
No, and Trump claimed 68 floors and always had. And, you know, you can find some clips from, like, 2003 before he started running for president where he's very transparent about, like, yeah, it sounds better to say 68. And so I just renumbered the floors and said there's 68 floors. He has another tower that he claims is 90 floors and it's only 70. You know, that's just how he operated. And the Times actually had this great story saying that other New York developers around that time were like, hey, we should lie too. And so Trump started a trend that other people copied.
Well, it saves a lot of money if you can have a tower with 68 floors are having to build the extra 10 floors, because I understand those floors are pretty expensive.
Right. So I'm coming to you now from the 130th floor of the Washington Post building instead of the 7th. We're just going to not count a lot of those.
I hear it's much safer up there than it is down near the ground.
Exactly.
So let's see. One more thing I can pump you for information on. Has anybody smuggled the full Mueller report under your door?
No, and that's a serious lapse on my part as a reporter and also on the part of my sources. So, no, as far as I know, nobody else has it. It's been kept pretty close.
And is it going to be so, because I'm hearing predictions is going to be so heavily redacted that we're not going to learn anything new or interesting from it. What's your sense?
I wouldn't make that prediction. I mean, Barr has said that the public will see it. He wrote a letter to Congress a couple days ago saying that, you know, people will be able to draw their full judgment from it when they see the report. And I don't think it's something you say if you're going to redact everything but the hello and goodbye. Some parts of it might be redacted, likely will be redacted because there's some grand jury material in there. But Barr at least has said that people will really get to see the report. And that to me indicates a largely unredacted report.
Yeah. Okay, I should point out that if they do manage to slip it under your door, you better get your door checked because it's got some serious carpentry required.
Right, exactly.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
David Farenthold joining us live from the Washington Post, as he does each Tuesday on Seattle's Morning News. How much garbage do you create in a single day? I just finished my daily morning tea, and the cup says it is compostable, but I have no idea whether it will actually be composted. And even when you do your best to reduce the amount of garbage you create, it is still likely more than zero. And yet some people see zero waste as a realistic, reachable goal, while others do the best they can. Here's Rachel Bell.
If the zero waste movement has a mascot, it's the mason jar. Plastic abhorring people bring mason jars to the grocery store to load up on bulk lentils or granola. They're used as water glasses and as earth-friendly containers for office-bound lunches. But the most zealous zero wasters often boast that they throw away so little garbage they can fit a year's worth into a single mason jar. And that can be a little extreme and intimidating for the average person looking for inspiration to reduce waste in their homes.
There's been a lot of talk of kind of rejecting the trash jar concept on social media, which I'm really glad about.
That's Seattle's April Dickinson, known as the Zero Waste Dork on Instagram. A few years ago, Dickinson was inspired to reduce her family's waste after watching a documentary series on CNN.
I saw that and I thought, oh my God, we have to change everything. My partner saw it and he was like, neat. Next show. So it's been a little bit of a challenge going at it on my own.
I wanted to feature April in this story because her quest to go zero waste is realistic. She doesn't measure her success in mason jars. She just does as much as she can. And April's partner and two young children are not as gung-ho on reducing waste because it means giving up some of the quick and easy conveniences that they love. So April started small.
I knew that we did not need to buy any more of those little cute individually wrapped slices of cheese. We loved those because you could pop them in your backpack. Individually wrapping two bites of cheese is not great. And then I also eliminated things like fruit snacks and granola bars. So we went to the bulk section and found snacks in the bulk section that easily replaced those items. So they found options that they love now, and they don't even think about fruit snacks and granola bars anymore.
Of course, when she shops in the bulk section, she brings her own bags. And as zero waste becomes more popular, companies are starting to commercialize on the movement by making you believe that you need to buy certain products in order to use less plastic.
For instance, produce bags. You could go on Amazon and buy, you know, a pack of produce bags, but you could also take one plastic produce bag and reuse it many, many times. That's free. Really think about putting value back into things that we already own. Maybe there's something in your house you can repurpose.
For April, it's all about balance. She makes her own deodorant to avoid the plastic packaging.
For laundry, I actually this fall harvested chestnuts from my driveway, and you can make a laundry detergent from dried chestnuts. So I've been using that. Yeah. pretty unusual. And you obviously have to have access to those chestnuts, but that's been working out for us.
She also bakes her own bread, but she does draw the line at making homemade yogurt.
Just by being a little bit more thoughtful about things that seem really wasteful, you can actually reduce it by quite a bit and still not feel like you have to be a total granola munching, like tree hugger, you know, like you can still navigate through systems and reduce your impact.
There are definitely things she's given up that she misses, like potato chips. Potato chip bags are not recyclable. And she recognizes that it would be nearly impossible for people from other cultures to give up the foods they cook with.
So I'm biracial, I'm half Chinese, and there are some, you know, Chinese snacks that I really wish I could find zero waste. I just don't buy them anymore. I let my like aunts and my mom buy it, and then I'll eat it sometimes when I'm with them.
Stay tuned for the second half of my little zero waste series. Tomorrow, I'm going to tell you about a couple of places that allow you to buy cleaning and beauty products in bulk.
So the first thing that strikes me, Rachel, is that this takes a lot of time. And I always considered myself proud of what I try to do to help the environment. But what gets in the way of me taking the next step and reducing my even recycling is that I don't have time.
Yeah.
It seems like it takes a lot of time to do what she's doing.
I think some little things, like she said, she stopped buying those individual two bites of cheese that are wrapped. And so instead she buys a big, you know, a giant block and cuts it up. That doesn't take that much time to cut a few slices of cheese. So there are little things like that. For me, I have been trying to reduce waste. I'm more environmental than the average person, but I found it to be more expensive. And that to me means that most people can't do it. The stores that do the bulk tend to be higher end. I will share tomorrow. There are places where you can do that and it costs exactly the same as you paid initially.
And maybe something you can look into if you don't already know is the places you can go where you want to buy deli items or you want to buy the pre-made food and you can bring your own containers. I've been turned down a lot of the times when I try to do that for health state health violation reasons.
It's against state law. I did a story on that earlier this year, and it's a bummer. That's the whole problem with all of this is once you, okay, here's the thing. Once you start going into this zero waste land, I feel so much guilt. I went into my grocery store last week and all I see is plastic.
Waste,
I'm just walking and I'm like, plastic, plastic, plastic.
It's overwhelming.
I heard something the other day that really struck me, which was we've been told that this is our responsibility just as individuals, but as much as we reduce, the companies are still making all of these products. There needs to be something on a larger level, you know, like the straw ban and plastic bag bans. Like those are the only things that make the big differences. And I'm not saying not to make an effort, and I will continue to, because big change starts with small change.
Right.
But I don't think we can just do it on an individual basis. We have to make bigger legislative change.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you. I'll be back tomorrow.
I looked up the whole chestnut detergent thing. And what it is you take horse chestnuts, which are not edible, and you grind them up in like a little blender and let them soak in water overnight, and you get this milky stuff, and you strain that, and that's the detergent. And it only takes 11 pounds of chestnuts to get you through a year of clothes washing.